This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Every single kid in middle school is going to get dumped by a friend, because this is when you're doing that work of figuring out how to be a friend, what you need from a friend. And as much as we would like to wrap our kids in bubble wrap and protect them from those kinds of wounds, we really don't do them any long-term service. The greater gift is to teach them how to navigate those kinds of setbacks and help them learn how to move on from a friendship that's no longer working for them, so that when they're older, they can make better decisions with relationships. If they need to leave a job where they have a supervisor that's unkind to them, we want them to learn how to do that when they're still with us and not much later in life when the stakes are higher.
That was Phyllis Fagel on Psychologists Off the Clock.
We are four experts in psychology here to bring you cutting-edge and science-based ideas from psychology to help you flourish in your relationships, work, and health.
I'm Dr. Debbie Sorensen, a clinical psychologist practicing in Mile High, Denver, Colorado, and author of Act for Burnout, Act Daily Journal, and the Act Daily Card Deck.
From America's Heartland, I'm Dr. Emily Edlin, a clinical psychologist based in Chicago, Illinois, and author of Autonomy Supportive Parenting.
Calling in from Vienna, Austria, I'm Michael Herold, ACT coach, confidence trainer, and author of an upcoming book on being a better conversationalist and making friends.
And from coastal New England, I'm Dr. Jill Stoddard, author of Be Mighty, The Big Book of ACT Metaphors, and Imposter No More.
We hope you take what you learn here to build a rich and meaningful life.
Thank you for listening to Psychologists Off the Clock.
Small behaviors can make a big difference in our health and well-being. Most of us work so many hours each week that we should think about how our work habits affect our bodies. Being able to stand sometimes while I work has made a huge difference for me. Uplift Desks has created high-quality office furniture designed to help you work better and live healthier. My Uplift standing desk allows me to easily transition from sitting to standing while I work with just the push of a button. I feel so much better than when I sit all day, and it helps me recharge to change positions when I get tired in the afternoon. In addition to standing desks, Uplift offers ergonomic office seating, storage systems, even walking treadmills for your desk. You can get free shipping with no hassles, free 30-day returns and return shipping, and a 15-year warranty. Remember, by supporting our sponsors, you're supporting the podcast. Visit UpliftDesk.com/POTC for 5% off your order. That's UpliftDesk.com/POTC to get 5% off your entire order.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hi, everyone. I'm here with Jill today to talk about my interview with Phyllis Fagel, the middle school whisperer. I really hope every adult who interacts with a middle schooler in their lives, or who will in the future, listens to this discussion, because it covers so much territory and we didn't even get to maybe half of my questions. But overall, Phyllis really gives us all a gift of reframing these years as rich instead of the worst years ever, which I hear a lot of adults describe middle school that way. But she strikes this really lovely balance between normalizing what may totally confound us, like constantly shifting friendships, and giving us tools to support our kids through these years in ways that really meets them where they're at developmentally, but also builds their resilience. So, Jill, I'm curious what you thought.
Well, I absolutely loved this episode. It was one of those episodes that when it ended, I was like, wait, what? How has it already been an hour? And I just was left wanting more and more and more. I love Phyllis. I remember feeling the same way when I interviewed her about her book, Middle School Matters. And I think, you know, for me, the takeaway really was I felt like I could relax. I felt validated and seen, but also comforted. It wasn't just validation that yes, you know, this is a hard time. It was really comforting to, I felt like I could let go. And in fact, Emily, I was even thinking a lot about the ways in which this book overlaps with your work on autonomy supportive parenting and just the benefits of sort of letting go of control, meeting kids where they're at and recognizing that they're at this age where we start to see them more as little adults, I think, because they're just developing so much. And yet we also have to remember that they're still just middle schoolers. You talk in your episode about, you know, where they're actually at in terms of their executive functioning development and what they are and are not capable of. Anyway, so that like, I found it validating. I found it comforting. I actually really especially loved some of the stats that she shared because those to me were sort of mind-boggling stats specifically about friendships, that I thought not only were comforting to me in terms of the anxiety I have about my middle school daughter's social life, but something that I'm going to tuck away to be able to share with her as well.
Yeah. And, you know, so I have two middle schoolers right now, and I do therapy with this age group as well. And I can tell you that that shifting friendship theme is prevalent. I mean, it is going to happen. And I think it's being open and aware and using our wisdom, you know, with our fully developed brains to support our kids while knowing they have to go through this experience and these really tough social experiences to develop the skills they need for their life. And so I think a big part of this discussion, and not just socially, but academically and with stress and resilience, that my big takeaway was, and you're right, it's in line with my autonomy supportive parenting work, but the biggest takeaway is our job is really to support them in developing the skills that they need for their lives, not to avoid stress and live their perfect lives right now, because there is no such thing for one thing. But I think there's an illusion that somehow if we parent right, that middle school won't be as tough or as challenging. But even that, we need to look at all the gifts and rich opportunities that these years have to offer as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, high school is also challenging and life after high school is challenging. Life is always challenging. And I think the two of you really make that point is that you're equipping them with what they need to be able to manage the challenges of their lives going forward. And a lot of that really starts around this age. They're sort of insulated, I guess, through elementary school. And you know, shit gets real once you're in middle school. And, you know, there's nothing, we can't stop it. We can't protect them from it, but we can support them to teach them the best skills to get through it effectively.
Right. And knowing there will be mistakes and missteps, and we still want our kids talking to us about it as much as possible, rather than feeling like they can't share that with us, because that's how they learn the most too.
And Phyllis really gives specific strategies for how to do that, which I always so appreciate.
Absolutely. I mean, she is just a treasure trove of wisdom that all of us can benefit from. And on top of that, she's a truly lovely person. So
the Middle School Whisperer is the absolute perfect nickname for her. I love it. It's awesome.
So I hope everyone who has or will have a middle schooler in their lives listens to this episode and gets as much out of it as we did. Phyllis Fagel is a practicing school counselor, a psychotherapist who works with children and teens in private practice, and an author and journalist. She is the author of Middle School Matters, The 10 Key Skills Kids Need to Thrive in Middle School and Beyond, and How Parents Can Help, and her most recent book that we're discussing today, Middle School Superpowers, Raising Resilient Tweens in Turbulent Times. Phyllis is a frequent contributor to publications such as The Washington Post and CNN, and her ideas have been shared in outlets including The New York Times, NPR, The Chicago Tribune, and The Atlantic. Phyllis has three children and lives in Bethesda, Maryland. Hi, Phyllis.
Hi. So nice to be here with you finally. I was looking forward to this.
Me too. So Phyllis and I have sort of been friendly over the years as writers in the parenting space while also being therapists and working with kids and teens. So it's quite the combo.
Yes. And it's always nice to talk to other people wearing the same collection of hats.
Right. So I actually wanted to start with my own experience. I am currently a parent of two middle schoolers, and I actually read Middle School Matters the summer before my oldest started sixth grade. And now I got to read Middle School Superpowers when my middle child just started, and my oldest is now an eighth grader. So thank you for timing your books with my personal journey. I really appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for reading the books.
But they really validate, I think, a lot of what we worry about as parents. You really validate that what's going on are often very developmentally normal challenges, and it eased a lot of my own anxieties and worries about, is this okay? Is my kid going to be okay? So I have to say that any first-time parents of middle schoolers would really benefit, but I even benefited from another read as my kids are older and in different phases. So I was reading Middle School Superpowers as a parent, but also as a therapist who works with this age group as well. And it may be easier to see when they aren't your own kids, but this tween to early teen age group really is special and has a lot of gifts to offer. And one of my favorite parts of your book is how you share the joys of this age group with really hilarious and profound quotes from actual students you've worked with that start each chapter. I laughed out loud, like, multiple times. So you did use superpowers in the title of your book. So let's start with what you love about working with and writing about this age group.
I always say that if you're having a bad day and you need to change your mood, you should either go hang out with a sixth or seventh grader or a kindergartner. And there are a lot of parallels. There's sort of this combination of complete lack of self-consciousness at times with this desire to please the adults who are supporting them, plus that desire to be independent while also lacking a lot of the skills that you need to execute on the things that matter to you. You're so worried about doing the wrong thing or making a mistake. And so you're open to feedback. You're open to support. And I think that often adults so fear this phase, maybe because they had a bad experience, or maybe because they have watched Mean Girls recently, or they've heard from their friends that this is a hard phase or that kids are mean and drama seeking. That's not my experience at all. So part of the reason I wrote the book was to really change the narrative about how we talk about these very funny creatures.
What do you see as the reason parents need your book? So thinking about where we as a group seem to be struggling in understanding or supporting our middle schoolers?
That's a great question. And full disclosure, I write the books that I need myself. And I write about the topics and the scenarios and the research that I think will help me do my job better and also be a better parent, be a better therapist, better school counselor. And I wrote this one in particular because in the last few years, I don't think anyone has neglected to notice that the world has been a little chaotic and kids are sponges. They're absorbing all of the anxiety in the world that their adults in their lives are experiencing, that they're seeing on the news, that they're seeing in that magic little machine in their pocket 24/7. They are at the same time changing so rapidly internally and externally. Their friendships are extremely fragile and unstable. Their sense of self is still developing. And when you put it all together, I really felt that we needed this new set of strategies. I call them extreme tweens because they're the same middle schoolers, but on steroids. And I started to pay attention to what was working with these extreme tweens and what wasn't, and which kids were faring better than others. And from there, I came up with this set of strengths or skills that became ultimately middle school superpowers. And I do want, as a disclaimer, since I work with middle schoolers, to say that I would never, ever use that term with middle schoolers themselves because they would think it was so cheesy and make relentless fun of me. It's for the adults. It's really right. Just to talk about that strengths-based approach.
Right. They would stop listening as soon as they heard superpowers, right?
Yes.
But we'll take it. I think it's a really incredible framework for parents with the strength-based and positive focus and where we can really leverage the strengths of this developmental period. And I think the way you talk about this really is the same old middle schoolers, but on steroids with everything going on in the world, is important for us all to remember that we're parenting in a landscape that's different from when we were their age.
Yes, you can ask any educator, the kids that they've been working with for the last few years. And while the dial is moving and kids are starting to return to, I won't say normal because there's nothing normal about the world right now, but they are acquiring a lot of the skills that they didn't have a chance to develop during the pandemic. So they're a little less sensitive maybe than a couple of years ago, but they're still extreme tweens and they still need a lot of help. And even as a mental health professional, I feel like there are so many things that we can do to support them that are not therapy. And I'm never opposed to therapy. That's always helpful as long as you have a competent therapist working with you. But so much of what kids are struggling with and that we read as anxiety or depression can be managed by helping them get organized or figure out how to join a conversation or invite someone over. And that's where I think the books that I write really are useful because I'm looking for practical ways to get in there and coach them in a way that they're willing to take that help. And that might ease some of the anxiety that we see on the other end if they don't feel all of those things they need to feel that sense of belonging and to feel confident.
I really love this point because I think with the headlines about youth mental health and that we're in a crisis and rates of anxiety and depression are the worst ever, I think parents are really scared about how their child is doing. And in my practice, I have seen parents reaching out for therapy and then we meet the kids and they're really doing pretty well and functioning quite well across their life. All relative. It's all relative. But I think you're right. There is so much we can be doing at home and therapy doesn't need to be the first step to figuring out when your kid starts acting differently or seems a little down or they're more moody than they used to be. I mean, I think parents' antenna are a little too alert right now.
I've seen that too, and I'm really empathetic. I think the headlines are scary and always better to err on the side of caution. At least in that situation, you are able to ease their anxiety, even if it was only one or two sessions. And even in therapy, what I've been finding is that sometimes the most helpful things to do with kids relate to helping them empty out their backpack and figure out what they need to do and get a handle on all of those executive functioning skills that have not yet developed because kids are not at a point in brain development where they have those skills. Mm-hmm. Often have to reassure parents that their kids aren't lazy. They just don't have future planning skills. So we can do a lot to ease that burden on them simply by helping them label what it is they're feeling and why they're feeling that way. Kids will say, I'm anxious. They hear the words too, or they'll say, another clue might be, they'll say, I'm overwhelmed.
Yep.
And if we can help them break it down, then we can come up with the solution that will be helpful for them. Kids themselves, especially in this age group, have a really hard time drilling down with any specificity to why they're feeling a certain way. So they might say that they're sad and we could jump in and come up with a solution for them. But if we don't know why they're sad, we're probably not going to help them arrive at the right solution. If they're sad because they're lonely, then maybe they need to reach out to a friend. If they're sad because they bombed a quiz that they really cared about in a class they thought they were really proficient in, then the answer might be meeting with the teacher to get some reassurance or to change how they study or to study in a group. There are all sorts of different ways that we can support them. And the beautiful thing about middle schoolers is that no matter how low they are, for the most part, it can turn around on a dime.
Yes.
Which is so wonderful.
Yeah. The power of time you know, and a good night's sleep. And let's talk in the morning. So you are already touching on a lot of what I want us to cover today. And I know we're not even going to get through everything I'm so excited to talk to you about. So people have to just get your book. But I want to set the stage by acknowledging you already brought up the world we're in right now, that the middle schoolers are living in, that we're parenting in, and that besides the pandemic, which is obvious, you point out our kids are also living with divisive politics, racism, emergency drills, school violence, economic instability, and climate change. And I hear this from the kids I work with, that these anxieties are sitting in them about the world. It can feel overwhelming for us to know how to support them with all of that. So what are your tips for us to help provide a foundation of security in these chaotic and scary times?
First, I'm seeing that too. For the first time, I have kids who are referred to me purely because they have fear about safety drills, or even something like a fire alarm can trigger tremendous anxiety. And you also have a lot of kids who have that existential dread. And in addition to the list that you just read, we now have war in the Middle East on top of war in Ukraine. So these are kids who know that the rug can be pulled out from under them at any point. And just when it seems like things can't get worse, they get worse. So they're not growing up in the same way that we did. And if they're experiencing that as just general sense of that dread, it can be too much. It can be overwhelming. So one of the things parents can do is help them zoom back in, focus on something they have to do that day, that hour, or they can think about one way they might be able to make a difference in whatever arena it is that's causing them distress. If they care about animals, maybe they can read to dogs in a shelter. If they're worried about the climate crisis, maybe they could write to a legislator and advocate for better laws. Same for gun violence. So really giving them back that sense of agency, helping them drill down to what's going on, not only in their own community or their own school, but literally in their own day, and focusing in. So especially for kids who are gifted, they tend to go really, really big picture, and they tend to be more sensitive often too. And it can make it impossible for them to focus at school. It can lead to all kinds of mental health challenges. So we can help bring them back into their own life.
I love that. I think that's also really good advice for all ages, right? I think we can all do a better job of that in our lives. And if we can do it and feel the benefits, we can model for our kids and like give them the example of how it works for us too.
Yes. And last night I was watching the news and my 15-year-old came in and I suddenly was aware how tense I was watching the news. And I said out loud, you know what, I'm going to turn off the TV. Part of it was I didn't want him to see some of the really disturbing images. It's bad enough to read about it. And I said out loud, I'm going to turn off the TV because I just need a break from this onslaught of terribleness. And he said, I can handle it. I can handle it. And I said, no, it's not about you. Actually, it's really, this is self-care for me. I need to take a break from watching this. It's not that I don't care about it. I do. I care so much that it's hard to watch it all day long. And that's another way we can help them.
Right. So showing the boundaries that can be important for our own health in engaging with the world on a day-to-day basis. So let's talk about the superpowers. Each chapter focuses on a different superpower, and there's 12 in all. So I thought it might be helpful if we tackle some common parenting worries and challenges in middle school, and then you can kind of talk about how different superpowers might come into play for these challenges.
I like it.
So I've heard this from a lot of parents, and I definitely went through it when my oldest, I mean, it was right after she turned 12, I felt like she disappeared in our house. Like she no longer was in the family space and just wanted to be up in the attic alone all the time. And it was abrupt, and I wasn't sure, even as a therapist, and maybe because I'm a therapist, you know, wondering, should I be worried about this? So let's talk about that. What would you say to parents who might be concerned that there's something wrong when this happens and they're always in their room?
Well, first to channel my seventh grade students who will often say to me, can you please tell our parents not to ask us over and over again, are you okay? Are you okay? sort of digging for dirt, mining for misery. None of that is helpful to them for a couple of reasons. One, it focuses in on the negative, which might bring them to a place that is worse than where they are. Second is that what kids tell me is that when someone says, are you okay? They have that knee-jerk reaction, I'm fine. And then they feel like they've missed their opportunity if they're not. So it's a lot more effective just to check in frequently in very low stakes, non-judgmental, non-critical ways. You know, hey, do you want a snack? You doing okay in here? Anything I can do to help? And just keep those lines of communication open. I interviewed a former principal in the book who shared a strategy that one of the parents he knew had used, which was at 9 o'clock or so at night, she would make cookies or brownies or something that smelled really good. And as if they were in a trance, her four sons would kind of come downstairs, sit at the table, and they'd have their best conversations, which I think is partially the brownies and partially the time of day. Often we try to have these big conversations with our kids or even getting any morsels of information from them right after school when they are still recovering from the onslaught of interactions they had to manage over the course of the day with teachers, with friends, worrying that they might embarrass themselves by offering the wrong answer, feeling like someone jostled them in the hallway and it was annoying and was it on purpose? There's so many things going on in their heads that we need to allow them that time to recover. And that might look like going to their room. It might look like them not talking. My friend who's a social worker calls it her kid's grunting phase, which it is because their processing turns inward. Where I think parents get confused is that they interpret that to mean that their kids don't want to engage or they don't want to get advice from you or they don't want you to support them. They do. They just need to do it you just need to do it in a way that doesn't feel as intrusive. You're doing it on their terms. You're doing it in ways that are less personal. So rather than talk about them directly, you might ask them a question about a friend or share something you read in a book or saw in the news and ask them if it rings true. You know, I think the example I use in the book was something like, I just read an article that only 5% of kids are vaping in middle school, and it's actually much lower than it was a few years ago. Does that surprise you? Because it probably will. It's a way to initiate a conversation. They're getting all kinds of misinformation themselves, which makes them feel a lot of pressure to grow up faster than they might want to grow up. But it's not personal. You're not saying, are you vaping? Did anyone get Yes, it's, yes. And there's no threat that you're going to give them a dramatic reaction or that they'll be in trouble.
Right. It's a safe way to explore and open those lines of communication. I learned the value. You're totally right about it needs to be so much on their terms. It can't be when we're ready to have the conversation at all. I just had to let go of that. And as a therapist who works with kids, I'm used to asking a lot of questions, which my kids will correct me and say, stop being so therapist-y. But I finally learned, you know, driving to Target or Starbucks is this prime time for really deep talks because my daughter gets really excited to go to both of those places. So she's kind of in a good mood. And I do think she enjoys her time with me when it's, especially when it's something like that. But we have some really deep talks, and it is that whole, hey, I read about this trend on TikTok. Have you seen it? What do you think about it? And so you're showing interest and curiosity without judgment.
Yes. Yes. I love that approach. You also don't have eye contact if you're in the car.
Yep.
And that feels a little bit easier for a lot of kids. You can play a game when I'm working with kids in private practice, I love to play pickup sticks or Jenga because you're concentrating enough that it can calm your body a little bit. You're not making eye contact constantly, so your hands are busy. It's why kids often do better in class with a fidget. It just allows them to settle into themselves a little bit because they have so much going on. There's so much interference at any given moment. They're thinking about what someone else is doing and what they look like and whether they're going to do okay on that quiz or whether they should try out for that team and what if their friend gets on and they don't get on. And to us, all we see is this, you know, stone wall. We don't see any of it. It's all there and it's all going on. If we want to tap into it, though, we have to be really careful in how we wade into those waters.
Careful and flexible. And yes. I would say persistent in the sense of if it didn't work this one time, try again the next day, you know, in a different way.
Yes. And
yes. So, right. So if your child is disappearing or shutting down more than they used to, especially around starting middle school, it's probably normal as they're processing so much in their daily life, right? Yeah. And so it's finding different ways to connect with them.
Yeah, and not making assumptions. So I think some of the really typical assumptions that a parent might make are that because their kid doesn't have a ton of friends, that means they're unhappy or lonely, that because they're not friends with the kids that they want to be friends with, that their social life is over. And we want to make sure that we're modeling some equanimity and that we believe that things will be okay and work out and that they have the capacity to figure it out with our support. Or else what they hear is my parents don't think I'm cool enough, or my parents think something is wrong with me that I don't have 15 friends like my neighbor Joey. And then they feel that sense of self-disappointment, you know, disappointment in themselves. So we want to make sure that rather than making that assumption, that we're asking more general questions and making observations and pointing out when they have a friend who seems to make them feel really good. I think I quote a kid in the book who I said to her, believe it or not, you know, there's research showing that popular kids are not happier than kids who are not popular. And she looked at me and she said, no offense, but I'm going to need to see that so-called research, which I thought was great because it's true. It does feel like the world is ending if you don't have that social friend group that you want to be a part of. But meanwhile, a lot of the kids who have that popularity or they're higher in that pecking order are pretty miserable. For one, you have to work really hard to maintain that spot, which is a lot of pressure. Number two, all the research shows that kids are stepping on the heads of the people below them to get that status. So the higher up you get, the more likely you are to be surrounded by fair weather friends.
Yes. Yep. I've seen that in my own kids' social circles constantly changing. But this is perfect because I want to talk about friendships next. This is probably what I hear most from parents around their own concerns. And I think where we run the risk of projecting our own middle school experience socially, because it's so powerful and it can imprint, right, so painfully. And you talk about these challenges in ways that I find really normalizing and validating. And you're not villainizing any of the kids. I mean, this is a time of experimentation where they might not treat other people as well as we would like them to. So there are a few things I hear from parents that I want to get your take on. Either parents are stressed that their child is no longer being included by a former group of friends. So kind of that transition from elementary to middle school, all of a sudden, they're not part of the group, which is so painful, or a child struggling to make friends in the first place, or a child who might be doing the excluding.
Yeah. So I'll share just an anecdote from kids that I've been working with this fall. It was a time of year when there's a lot of school dances at various different schools, and I work with kids from lots of different schools. And I had one parent preview for me that when I met with her daughter, that she might be upset because she had been excluded from a group of kids that would be meeting up after this dance to hang out. And she was really upset with the friend because this was a childhood friend who her daughter had always been a really loyal friend too. And it felt like a personal affront that this person would turn on her. And I had a hunch that this kid probably was interested in including her friend, but also wanted to be part of this other group, didn't know how to ask to include her friend or didn't want to jeopardize her own invitation. Or maybe she did ask and the friend group said, no, there's no room for anyone else, you know, as kids can sometimes do. And I still don't know what the background was to that story, but I then met with another kid. This was a boy, had nothing to do with the first situation, but he was struggling because he had been invited to a party with the cool kids. And he had initially committed to doing something with his childhood friend and was really conflicted because he wanted to go with the new kids. He was a little bit sick of the old friend just because this is what happens at this phase. Kids want to spread their wings, but he didn't want to hurt the old friend. And so he had split the difference and asked the new friends if they would invite his old friend. And they said no.
Wow.
And it was this light bulb moment because it was exactly what I thought. I couldn't say for sure what had happened in the first kid situation, but that's the kind of nuance that I think parents not only need to understand, but can help their kids by conveying to them that rejection or what feels like rejection might be a lot more complicated than they think. And yeah. I think that can soften. It doesn't make the pain go away. It doesn't make those friendship transitions easy, but it can help depersonalize it just a little bit and make them feel a bit more positive about themselves.
Yep. I think that's really helpful. And you talk about it a lot in super belonging, that superpower, right? And finding that sense of belonging. And there's actually a statistic that you share in both books, and I remembered it from the first book and constantly actually share it with middle schoolers. And that's the 2%. Do you know what I'm talking about?
How many people stay friends from 7th to 12th grade?
Yep.
Doesn't it blow your mind?
Yes, it does.
I share that one in the first book, but I'll share a few other statistics as well from the second one. So if you follow kids from 7th grade to 12th grade, only 1% of those friendships stay constant and are still existing all those years later. If you ask kids to name their best friend in middle school, only half of their friends will name them back. If you follow kids from the beginning of 6th grade to the end of 6th grade, only 1/3 of those friendships are stable. And 12% of 6th graders have nobody name them as a friend. And I share those statistics with kids because it reinforces what I was just sharing with those two anecdotes. So much of this is not personal. Every kid, and I say this in that chapter too, every single kid in middle school is going to get dumped by a friend because this is when you're doing that work of figuring out how to be a friend, what you need from a friend. And as much as we would like to wrap our kids in bubble wrap and protect them from those kinds of wounds, we really don't do them any long-term service. The greater gift is to teach them how to navigate those kinds of setbacks and help them learn how to move on from a friendship that's no longer working for them so that when they're older, they can make better decisions with relationships. If they need to leave a job where they have a supervisor that's unkind to them, we want them to learn how to do that when they're still with us and not much later in life when the stakes are higher.
Right. So seeing it more as instead of protecting them, it's an opportunity to help them develop really important skills, including, I think, the confidence that they got through it, you know, and they can, as they get older, look back and say, well, I remember that time in 7th grade when my best friend dumped me and how awful it was. And I ended up okay. I made these other new great friends or whatever happens.
And it often reflects some other traits that your child has that you can comment on and compliment them on. I quote a dad in the book who would tell his own teen when she was dumped by a friend and had tried really, really hard to save that friendship. You know, I'm proud of you for giving a dubious friend the benefit of the doubt for as long as you did, because often it is the most optimistic, kindest, generous kids who have the hardest time walking away from a friendship that isn't working for them. And that's something to be praising and celebrating too, because more often than not, that's going to end in really happy outcomes. Once in a while, they will get hurt, but it is not an all, you know, zero sum thing to be that way.
Right. And remembering, you know, this is setting them up for a lifetime of relationships. And we did not have these skills at this age either. So it's kind of easier for us in hindsight to maybe expect more from our kids than they really are built with right now. And this is how they build that, is by actually going through the tough stuff.
Yes. And if the world has shown us anything, it's that no matter what we do to protect them from the bumps in middle school, we can't protect them from the lumps and bumps that they'll experience just from being human. Being alive comes with a tremendous amount of uncertainty, and it's a windy road. And the younger they are when we prepare them for that, when we can be there to help them recover, help them see their strengths as opposed to zeroing in on what they perceive as their weaknesses, helping them pivot and figure out what they need to do, even if it's one small step to feel a little bit better, helping them develop that self-awareness and the ability to make good friend choices. All of that are really, really important skills that parents can help kids develop in the middle school years.
Right. Thank you so much. I think that will be helpful to a lot of listeners to reframe some of these situations that can be painful to witness as our kids go through it. And that's just what our kids tell us about, right? Then there's also whatever's going on that we don't even know.
That's probably a blessing. There was a while when I was getting every single one of my older son's texts on my iPad. It was a glitch of some kind in the matrix.
No.
And for a very brief period of time, I was knowing way, way, way too much about everything and everyone in his life. And I begged him to fix it. He didn't seem to care that much. It sort of contradicted the stereotype that middle schoolers don't want you to know anything. He didn't really care how much I saw, but I was overloaded with information.
Right.
Spell checking was enough.
So let's talk about academics. Another hotspot of parenting. I actually read in Jennifer Wallace's book, Never Enough, about toxic achievement culture, that mothers' anxiety about their kids in school peaks in middle school. And it kind of makes sense that there's a big transition in terms of academic demands and kind of feeling like, okay, things are getting more serious now, but it risks us putting too much pressure on our kids because of our own anxiety. So my questions for you are, how freaked out should we get if our child doesn't seem to love school or if they have trouble keeping up, especially at the start of middle school?
So I consider middle school the last best chance, because while it might feel like the stakes are high, they're actually low. It's a really safe time to fail. And by fail, obviously, in certain parts of the country, that means like a B+,
right,
which is part of the issue.
Right.
But it also means that this is when they can figure out what they need to do to study or what tools they need. This is how, when they learn how to ask for help, if we do it right, from a teacher. This is when they begin to understand the ramifications of procrastination. This is when we can keep perfectionism from getting in their way if we notice that they're having trouble setting something aside. So the stakes are low, but they're high if we don't give them the opportunity to make these mistakes and learn from them. And particularly with regards to parental anxiety, kids have a PhD in their parents, tweens especially, and they know that you're anxious about it. And I talk in the book about how the science shows that given where tweens are in their brain development, they do not perform better because they think the stakes are high.
Yep.
I mean, no one performs better because they think they're lacking in some way. And then layer on top of that, you're talking about kids who are at an age when they're suddenly acutely aware of how they stack up to everyone else. They are completely terrified of embarrassing themselves and less likely to take risks. And so actually, the very best thing we can do is remove all of that pressure so that they continue to put themselves out there. They raise their hand. They allow themselves to make errors so they can learn what they need to do differently the next time before the stakes do get higher later on in their education. And so that they recognize that making these kinds of mistakes not only is something that won't disappoint us, it's something that we see as a necessary part of their journey. I think it's Ken Ginsberg. He's a developmental pediatrician who says the worst word that we can use with our child is the D word. I'm disappointed.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Just shut them down. It's so much more effective to approach them with some empathy. And first, you know, I bet it felt really bad to bomb that quiz. I know you worked hard.
Right.
And I can see you're pretty dejected. And ask them if they want your help before you just jump in. Wait until they're in a better frame of mind. When they're firing from the fight, flight, or freeze part of their brain, they're not going to be rational anyway. When they're calm, if they're open to help, you can have a conversation with them about what they learned from that experience or if there's anything that you can do to support them. You might discover that they studied the wrong worksheet or that they didn't leave themselves enough time because they were spending a really, really long time on one question. It might even turn out that they have a learning challenge, that's a clue that you need to investigate. So middle school is also a really good opportunity to be an anthropologist, really talk to their teachers, try to get a sense of what's going on, clue them into anything going on with your child. Let them know if they're spending 5 hours doing one subject's homework. That's not what they want either for your child, so that you can set them up for success. Success will beget success.
Right. I know. It helped me a lot to think about middle school as training grounds or like training wheels on, you know, the academic. Like that, yeah. This is when they get to, and their executive functioning, all those parts of the brain that help anyone do well in the school environment are underdeveloped when they start middle school, as you're saying. And that's so important to remember, you know, that they're, it's like, it's still under construction up there. And, but doing it is what builds it. So, yeah.
So lots of structure, lots of consistency, setting up a place where they can study, where it's quiet, where they're not surrounded by tons of papers and junk, you know, where they unclutter, take away the phone while they're studying. You can share the research showing that it gets in the way of their ability to get it done in any kind of efficient way. Could their grades even drop if they have a phone in sight, even if it's off? Yep. In Middle School Matters, I had interviewed a design thinker who, with his own kid, would put the phone in a sealed envelope and they could hang on to it because they were so anxious to let go of it, but it just wasn't something that they could use in that moment while they were studying, but really helping them recognize what they need. So some kids might need to do exercise after school before they settle down and do work. Other kids might need to be to just knock it out. They might not be using time they have during the school day when they could be getting stuff done. And then they have a lot of practices after school, which actually I have a chapter called Super Balance, because kids have less stamina right now than they used to. And so if they're struggling in school or if they're struggling in any way, it can help to take a look at that schedule and see if they're overburdened. And it might be that they can't do as much as they did prior to the pandemic or when they were in elementary school and didn't have as many subjects or as many teachers whose personalities they had to decipher in order to figure out how they could meet their demands and expectations.
I think that's such a great point, and something that I talk about and write about a lot is the idea of, I mean, really finding balance, which can take on so many different forms and look differently for each kid, what that means. But first, we need to do a better job, I think, of our own balance. But again, it is setting them up for a healthier life overall if they know what it feels like to have downtime and be able to relax and restore. And I think we do forget puberty is taxing, you know, just hormonally, emotionally, so much is going on and it's really takes their energy. So I think that's a good point that you make about their stamina and just being mindful. And especially if they speak up and say, I don't want to do track anymore, or I don't want to do soccer anymore, whatever sport maybe they've been doing, to really listen instead of trying to talk them into sticking with it.
And recognize that they may want to quit something but be afraid of letting you down because maybe they know you've sunk a lot of resources or you've done a ton of carpools or you take pride in the fact that they're good at it or it's part of their identity because it's been something they've engaged in their entire lives. But it may not be the direction that they're heading. So I am a big believer in letting kids quit. They have to finish their obligation to the team. If you've signed up for 6 violin lessons already and paid for them, they have to take the 6 lessons, but then let them pivot as long as they're trying at least one thing at a time. We do want them to be trying something. So making sure that we are giving them that sense of agency is really helpful for their well-being too. And that's also how they develop confidence, because we are showing them that we treat them as the expert in their own life, that they can stop something and start something else. We don't want to raise kids who think that no matter how bad something is, they can never walk away.
Right.
That's not the ideal end goal.
Right. I know. I think, you know, we had on the podcast Annie Duke on talking about her book, Quit, and she touches on the parents' fear of allowing their child to quit, that it's somehow going to destroy their character or, you know, build negative traits if you let your child quit. But she makes the argument that actually knowing when to quit is a really important life skill, because just sticking with something, I mean, think about staying with the wrong job for too long, how miserable you can be. And is that what we really want to be teaching? So it's a good reframe, I think, about that whole idea.
Yeah. And you're saying, whenever you're saying yes to one thing, you're saying no to something else. You don't know what area they're going to love or excel at, but you're giving them the opportunity to find out.
Right. Yep. I had my oldest was a competitive gymnast, and she did gymnastics from 6 to 12. And she hit a wall and just kind of lost interest, but decided to stick out one last season of competition because she wanted to stay with her friends. It was a socially driven motivation. But I watched how much it affected her performance to just not care anymore. And it wasn't worth it. It didn't have the same fun. She wasn't building skills anymore because she wasn't investing in it. And she still says to this day it was the best decision she ever made because her sister does it. So she's watching her sister do it. And she's like, I'm so glad I quit. I mean, she doesn't have any regrets.
I'm sure she's grateful to you for allowing her to make that choice too.
I hope so. She may not tell me that, but
maybe in about 10 years.
Deep down inside.
Yeah.
So in some of this section about school, there are a few things I definitely want us to touch on that I think are really helpful for parents. One is this rock, pebble, sand metaphor, and that is, again, about balance. Can you explain that?
So it's goes back to the idea of executive functioning skills and the fact that kids really don't have it. If you think about a kindergartner, they sometimes will do something that looks really silly and it's kind of cute, but they'll put on their backpack and then they'll try to put on their jacket. And it doesn't work. They get the sequence wrong. And then they're all frustrated. Similarly, middle schoolers at a different level of development are trying to figure it all out too. And so the rock, pebble, sand metaphor is this idea that there are certain non-negotiables in their lives, like sleep and going to school. Those are the rocks. Then there are things that are should-dos. That might be an obligation to a sport team, an after-school job. And then there are the want-to-dos, the things like going online or hanging out with your friends, going to the mall, whatever it might be. And all of them are important. But if you don't put your rocks in the jar before those should-dos, that the pebbles, and instead you put the sand in first, then there's no room for the rocks. So it's about helping kids understand that you have to do things in an order that allows you to have time for all of it. Otherwise, you end up overwhelmed, or you end up behind, or you are spending so much time doing one thing that you don't have any time for the other. And we don't want them to be neglecting their social life in order to study all the time. And we don't want them spending all their time socializing and not spending any time doing their homework. But it's about finding that balance. And along the same lines, something that I talk about in the book that might be, I don't know if it's still controversial, but it might be a little controversial, is this idea that sometimes our kids need a mental health day.
Yeah.
And if we are judicious about when we allow them to take it, but we do periodically let them have that mental health day, I think it sends a message that we trust them to take care of themselves, that how they feel matters. And we want them to have that confidence that when they're overwhelmed, they can take a step back. We want them to learn how to do it. We don't want to constantly do it for them, as long as they're not taking advantage of it. But everybody, whether you're 13 or, you know, 43, needs a break sometimes.
Right. And having that permission, especially in our culture of productivity, right?
Yes.
In this grind culture. So I think that's really useful for their long-term health too, is giving themselves permission after we give them permission to take a break. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Let's touch on maybe the most anxiety-provoking part of parenting, which is risky behaviors.
Yes.
So in some ways, it's really normal, right, for this age to think about experimenting with substances, be curious about sex, like the stuff is starting to come up. Most parents want to delay both as much as possible and probably see middle school as too soon. I mean, myself is included in that.
Same.
But you do share some good news here that there have been some significant declines since 2020 of at least drug use in eighth graders, for example. So it seems like there's still a lot we can be doing with this age group to decrease their chances of risky behaviors. Could you talk about that?
Yes, I think one way to do that, and when we've touched on it, is this idea of telling them at an age when they hate to be manipulated that the media is trying to make them believe that everyone is doing these things and letting them know that's not true. Another way is to just arm them with refusal phrases so that they have a plan in advance when they're not feeling that peer pressure. And by pressure, I don't mean coercion, it's behavior contagion, that when they're with kids they want to impress, they're not going to be thinking in the same part of their brain. Yeah. And so helping them think about what they might say, letting them blame it on you, telling them your parents would take away your phone for the rest of your life if they ever knew that you did this. You have a sports meet the next morning that's really important. Having some kind of exit strategy or word you use, code word with that you can call your parents, giving them permission if they're old enough and capable and you're comfortable with it, if they had to call an Uber to get out of a bad situation. But the main thing is having conversations about all of these topics and making your expectations clear and helping them understand why they might be tempted to do something and giving them a compelling counter argument for why they don't want to do those things. That's called inoculation theory, ahead of time, and not when they're subject to all of that interference, wanting to fit in, wanting to make someone laugh, not wanting to stick out, not wanting to look different, that middle schoolers feel.
And I found it really helpful to use those statistics, and you say that this age group will overestimate, right, the rates, like everyone's doing it. Everyone's vaping or everyone's drinking, when that's just not true. And so kind of debunking that myth for them, maybe they'll believe us, maybe they won't, but it's kind of challenging their assumption that they'll be the only ones not doing that.
Yes. And a great resource for that topic in particular is The Addiction Inoculation by Jessica Leahy, who really debunks a lot of parents' beliefs about the best way to handle these situations. For instance, we are better off telling them hard no rather than allowing them to experiment. The data shows that kids are less likely to develop any kind of substance abuse disorder if we take that hard line.
Yep. It's a great resource. And she talked about that book on the podcast. So people can look at that episode for more. All right. My last question. So in my life as a therapist and a mom, I think understanding normal child development, like what's going on in their brains and how important it is at this age that they separate from the family, has really helped me. But I also think in some ways I might be more fearful at times that my kids will do some risky things based on what I'm hearing in my practice. And that might make me stricter than I need to be. So it can be a tough balance, right? Of holding both roles, being the therapist for this age group and a mother of this age group. So I'm curious for you how being a middle school counselor, writing about middle school, and a parent at the same time has been a gift and a liability.
Well, it's a gift because I legitimately can come home and share stories without it being personal and say, does this surprise you? Or is this happening at your school? Or you know, what would you do if you were in this situation? So that's where I would say it's a gift. It's also a gift because my sense of the range of normal is probably much broader than other people's. And my belief that kids can recover from really hard challenges is very strong. So I don't panic. It takes a lot to get me to panic. I think it's a lot easier to stay calm and just support through some of these growing pains. I expect mistakes and I expect them to do a lot of the things that I'm telling them not to do. But I'm not shocked when it happens. And I don't believe that it portends that they're going to be this, you know, horrible decision maker for the rest of their life.
Right.
As a liability, I probably would say the same thing you said earlier. You know, when your kid said, don't use therapist speak.
Yeah.
It's very easy for them to wonder if I'm sharing something because I genuinely am curious or because I'm trying to get something out of them. And so they will tease me. It's very good natured, but I would say that's the biggest liability.
Yeah. They're like, what are you trying to get out of me, Mom?
Yeah. Yeah. I did have a kid once come to my office and say, hey, can I borrow that book you wrote about middle school? And I was like, it was a fifth grade girl. I said, yeah, but I mean, you can, but it's a parenting book. Are you sure? And she said, yeah, my dad is reading it and I want to know what crazy thing he's going to try on me next. That dad is in for quite a journey, I think. Yes. Well, good for her.
I'm going to get ahead of this. Those parents, they always have an agenda.
Yes.
Well, I love how your book just makes this a more positive experience overall. I mean, it really shifts the narrative from, oh, these are the hardest years, which people say, or middle school is the worst. It shifts that narrative. And I think it's really empowering as a parent to kind of know where to relax and not worry so much, and also know where to do very specific strategies to support their child where they need support, and knowing when to relax and when to get involved. It's a lot. It's a lot for parenting.
It is a lot. Parenting is so hard. And if the book makes it a little bit easier, I'm very happy. So that's nice to hear. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for your time today. And again, I had like pages more of questions that we did not get to, but this book truly is a gift to parents, educators, any adult who has a middle schooler in their life or will have a middle schooler in the future. It's not only validating about many of our fears and that they're normal, but you offer so many hands-on ways to help our children throughout the book. How we can talk to our kids, help them think critically, cope with challenges, develop resilience. I'm thinking in this process, we could find our own superpowers as parents too. So maybe that's your next book. So thank you so much for writing this book and sharing it with us today. Where can people find you?
I have a website, just phyllisfagel.com, and I'm on Instagram and what was Twitter at pfagel, Threads as well, and LinkedIn, Facebook, pretty much all of it. You can find me, and my email is on my website if you want to reach out.
Thank you so much, Phyllis.
Thank you. Thanks for having me today.
Thank you for listening to Psychologists Off the Clock. If you enjoy our podcast, you can help us out by leaving a review or contributing on Patreon.
You can get more psychology tips by subscribing to our newsletter and connecting with us on social media.
We'd like to thank our podcast production manager, Chadine Stout-Williams.
This podcast is for informational and entertainment purposes only and is not meant to be a substitute for mental health treatment. If you're looking for mental health treatment, please visit the resources page of our website, offtheclockpsych.com.